Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast from the Financial Times. I'm Isabella Kaminska. Today, we're bringing you the second edition of our movie review. We take movies from the deep, dark crevices of the past, or just the 80s, and see whether the economic messages buried within them still resonate today. And on this edition, I'm joined by Gavin Jackson, the FT Economics reporter, and Thomas Hale, capital markets correspondent. But we also have a special guest today. It's Martin Sambu, author of the FT's Free Lunch Daily Email, economics commentator, and all-round big brain on all matters cultural and economic. Guys, say hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
We're recording this podcast the week after the Trump won the US presidential office, so what better excuse than that than to look back to an era of similar political uncertainty, depression, and technological change. Consequently, on today's podcast, we'll be analysing the work of Charlie Chaplin, The Little Tramp. Three movies in particular, the 1925 film The Gold Rush, the 1931 film City Lights, and my personal favourite, the 1936 film Modern Times. To begin with, I thought we'd start with the basics. Martin, looking at Chaplin was your idea, so tell us a little bit about what drew you to the films and why you think they're still relevant today.
Yeah, I suggested Chaplin partly, well, he is one of the greatest filmmakers of the 20th century. He's also one of the greatest clowns of the 20th century. And I mean clown here in the good sense, right? Not a figure like Trump, but clowning as an art form. He really perfected the art form. The films are funny. It's kind of old-fashioned. A lot of it is sort of old-fashioned slapstick comedy that, you know, you don't really, it feels kind of old, but he does it so elegantly and beautifully that it's actually quite nice to watch. And beyond that, he has this deeply human touch, both to, you know, we can use big words like the human condition and the big questions of love and friendship and despair. But there's also a big political and social dimension of his films. And the films we're talking about are the ones from the late 20s and early 30s. And that is a period that has a lot of echoes today. So I thought that was another reason why they're interesting. Finally, a very personal reason for me is that as a father to a four-year-old, I realized these are films that people of all ages really can watch and be entertained by together. And, you know, if there are any listeners out there with kids, these are actually good films to start to talk about social and political themes.
Before we get to the actual films, I thought we'd spend some time talking about Chaplin himself and also the era and context he was living in. So, I mean, Martin, give us a glimpse of what was going on back then and a little bit of your own insight into Chaplin's life and what you find interesting.
Chaplin lived a long life. He was born in 1889 in London. Born into poverty and destitution, and born into a family, not so much a family actually, because his parents split up when he was a baby, but both parents were entertainers in the acting and singing profession, the vaudeville scene. He had a very tough childhood. His mother was mentally ill at various stages in his life. His father left them when he was a baby. So it was a childhood marked of poverty, violence, disruption, you know, pretty terrible stuff. But he was extremely talented and did well on the stage in London, then touring, then went to America in 1913, I believe, and very quickly got into the film industry, and the rest is history, if you like. He was enormously successful from the start and soon enough started his own studio, became independent, became very wealthy and very successful. So it's a sort of rags-to-riches story, that's part of it. But also he made films that really touched on what was going on in society at the time. So he was, he always remembered his own humble origins. But of course he knew the Great Gatsby life, if you like, the life of the super rich, because he was one of them. And in a lot of his films, you see that contrast between the very poor and the very rich living cheek by jowl, which was this great tension in the big new metropolis of the New World.
So, guys, I mean, there's a bit of a question as to whether or not he's a so-called communist, because that's one of the themes that runs through a lot of his work, is this, as you say, this divide between the rich and the poor. Gavin, Tom, what do you think?
Well, I don't think it'd be quite right to call him a communist, and maybe this is something we should get on later, because his films, to me, and they didn't really seem to have the kind of traditional Marxist theological theory of class struggle, in which, you know, two impersonal forces fight against one another to overcome them. They're like what Martin said about him being very human. It's always a human figure with the class struggle, or the class war, if you like, as a backdrop rather than the central tension within it. So I think, you know, maybe in the climate of McCarthyism, you could accuse him of being sympathetic to the idea of the USSR, but he wasn't really what I would call a communist. He was probably on the centre-left, or the left, but not to that level of extremeness.
Just on Gavin's point on McCarthyism, I think he was investigated in the post-war US for suspicion, like many figures in the media and the arts were, for suspicions of communism. But in terms of his films and the films we're talking about today, I got more of a sense of him as a kind of almost a removed commentator on many of the social and historical themes in that era, rather than someone necessarily engaged in a particular political ideology or a particular pushing a particular agenda. He seemed more of a commentator.
Chaplin himself never said he was a communist. He was clearly a sympathizer. He was he had many friends in the Soviet Union. He accepted awards. He called himself a citizen of the world, which is interesting today, given how that's an expression that's been denigrated by the UK Prime Minister. One of the great British citizens of the 20th century called himself that. But at a time when in America, calling yourself a citizen of the world, which he said when people complained that he hadn't taken US citizenship, was to many people kind of, you know, almost synonymous with being anti-American, un-American, and a communist. I don't think he was ever a member of the Communist Party. I would say he probably was a socialist. So I agree, it's not, you know, his films aren't first and foremost about the class struggle in this abstract Marxist sense. But I think they are very often about how the class struggle feels, and especially for those who are at the short end of it, right? The workers, or even worse, the unemployed, the proletariat, the dispossessed. So, you know, I think he has quite a lot of common with, you know, if we want to go very philosophical here, the young Marx rather than the older Marx, the Marx of the manuscripts of the 1840s rather than Marx of the capital, of capital.
You mean Marx were focused on alienation?
Exactly.
Rather than Marx focused on exploitation?
Exactly.
I mean, given all that, I think it's time to go into the first film, which is The Gold Rush. Tom, you had a sort of theory that it foreshadowed the Depression in many ways.
In part, yes. Also, I mean, the version I watched of this, it's quite difficult to find the original version online, but there is a 1942 edit of The Gold Rush with Chaplin's voiceover throughout the film and some subtle changes in the structuring of the film, which I think make the case stronger that, you know, when you watch The Gold Rush now, you can see the Depression in there, because this was such a dominant afterthought for Chaplin in the 40s. I mean, there's such grand scope in the film about the kind of the span of US history. A lot of the film is about simple, as Martin was saying, simple basic needs of the proletariat: hunger, starvation. The protagonist in the film is searching for gold in Alaska, searching for opportunity. There's a great scene where they've got nothing to eat, and they cook a boot. He boils a boot, and they carve up this boot. And Chaplin choreographs his comedy in such a way that he's almost got this well-practiced way to carve up this boot. He kind of splits it like a fish and eats it in a very specific way, almost as though hunger, starvation was so normalized that there was a blueprint for eating clothing. And of course, one of the great images from the Depression was starvation, was queues for soup kitchens. It's easy to forget how present hunger was in the daily lives of people watching Chaplin films. The other great image from the film, I thought, was a house perched on a precipice. And on the other side of the precipice is the gold mine, where one of the heroes, Big Jim, has found this gold, and this house is teetering on a cliff. A lot of the comedy is about, will the house fall off the cliff or not? And they eventually get out of the house on the other side, and as they release themselves from the house and land on this gold mine, the house literally falls off the cliff. I mean, I don't want to stretch things too far, but if you wanted a kind of visual metaphor for the role of, you know, gold, monetary expansion, and the impact it has on house prices falling off a cliff, then you don't need to look much further.
I think the metaphor works really well, and it goes further than that, because, you know, this is nominally about, let's say, the Klondike Gold Rush, 1898, right? So this is, the film was in 1925, so that's still within living memory. But what was going on in 1925, 4 years before the big Wall Street stock market crash, was a bubble, right? Think 2003, 2004, house prices going up, stock prices going up. I mean, the gold rush is the ultimate metaphor for the get-rich-quick dream, right? Which you see in every bubble. So this is also, when it was made, I think, very much influenced by how people behave in a bubble. Anyone can suddenly get rich quick if they just, you know, take risks that don't seem like risks, and then too many people do it, and then the bubble pops.
And when we say anyone, I mean even a tramp, even the most incompetent kind of bumbling tramp can become, as he does, a millionaire from gold in that film.
Yeah, so I think this is a good moment to talk about the character that Chaplin plays in all three of these films, who's the tramp. And this was a character that Charlie Chaplin came up with when he was working at the Keystone Studios. And he just came up with it because he went on, put on two baggy trousers and two tight waistcoat and a bowler hat. You're probably familiar with the image if you're familiar with Chaplin at all. And this is the character he plays through all three of the films, though he has different names in each one. And he's kind of this odd, awkward mix of vulnerability and naivety, essentially. He looks, he's very small, he's very malnourished, he's wearing odd-fitting clothes. And things sort of happen around him, or happen to him by accident. He's an agent of change, but not almost deliberate change.
You're right about the vulnerability and you know, being at the mercy of these social forces, right? And at the same time, the character is sort of a vehicle for this a sort of fortitude, right? There's this attempt, constant attempt at maintaining dignity in the face of really bad adversity. I mean, there's this wonderful scene in City Lights where he tries to keep some sort of pride when these newspaper boys are making fun of his tattered clothes and pulling a finger off his glove and so on. That probably reflects his own upbringing and his sensitivity to the condition of poverty. How do you maintain pride and dignity when everything seems to go against you and you struggle to just maintain the basic social functions? And, you know, I think that sort of theme may be one of the themes that we see at play in politics today, the kind of lack of pride or the struggle with dignity in the left-behind parts of the population.
But I would just jump in here and make the point that Chaplin seems to like to make fun of tragedy, and he likes to take advantage of absurd situations that I think in the Gold Rush, it's really epitomised by this idea that people will go to the ends of the earth to seek, like, gold, this supposed source of great wealth. And in reality, you know, when you get there, they're totally engulfed by poverty, they're eating their own shoes, etc. And I thought that entire episode was very indicative of his mentality with respect to this absurd situation. And also, it's interesting to note that he was apparently inspired by watching the real, authentic pictures of the Klondike Gold Rush pioneers going over the Chilkoot Pass. And then, you might have seen the pictures. They depict these huge undulating snake lines of people walking up the pass. Most of them, well, a lot of them would have died. And I think he was really struck by it. And that's why he wanted to do the film.
Well, I think there's another thing in that film I want to mention, which is he seems to take a view of wealth that it's almost random. So at the very end, he strikes it rich, right? And some newspaper men come to interview him, this famous tramp who got rich, and they ask him to put on his old tramp clothes. So he does, and then he falls over, and suddenly he's the tramp again. That, you know, wealth is almost something that's just random, that happens to you, and it's distinctive. And it's also, you can see that in your description of his life, was that he experienced poverty, experienced wealth, and so he sort of saw the difference, the distinction between the two classes was a bit arbitrary.
The thing that's related to that, you see, in each of these films, actually, there's a love story. I mean, he was a very sentimental, romantic guy and filmmaker as well. I mean, in his life, he had, I don't know how many women's stories, but four wives and many more liaisons. But in the gold rush. He falls in love with the most beautiful girl in the gold rush town, and she sort of humours him for a little bit and then kind of forgets about him because he's poor, he's uninteresting. So there's this point about how if you're poor, you kind of lose out in that game, but also a point about how the important things in life, love, your ability to love and to be of assistance to others, is not at all correlated with how rich you are. But that's what society values, and that theme comes back again and again.
Just on Gavin's point of how so much of the humour here relies on this figure of the tramp, who is this kind of, he has agency, but he's almost floating around in the world. Things, the world impacts itself upon him, and he doesn't, he has an effect, but he's kind of agencyless in some respects. There's all these coincidences. So much of the humour relies on coincidence. You know, this part of the pavement is sliding open at just this time, or this thing is falling at just this time. I think we can kind of broadly tie this type of humour itself into trends going on at that time in history with the way people understood historical change. At a time of vast economic change, where events felt like they were out of people's individual control, there was a move towards pointing towards chance and randomness in explaining the direction of history, the direction of events themselves happening. And I just thought, when I was watching the films, and I was reminded by what Gavin was saying, there's a sense that the humour, whilst it works on a very physical level, also seems to reflect that kind of philosophy.
That's a really interesting observation, and it makes me think that this is a reason why these films are more relevant again today, because we've been through a period, you know, people sometimes call it the great risk shift, right? Where more individual risk has fallen back on individuals after a post-war social democratic era where a lot of risk was socialized. Now people face much more risk in their individual lives. And we've also seen technological change, massive technological change that can make a multi-billionaire out of someone who puts together a website in their garage, right?
Yes, I would say that Bitcoin is definitely the modern Klondike rush, right? You know, the gold rush equivalent.
So moving on to City Lights, the format of the film being, I mean, there's kind of two stories, one in which Chaplin saves this millionaire from suicide, and the millionaire is an alcoholic, and you know, he loves Chaplin for saving him, or the tramp, sorry, for saving him, but he only recognizes him when he's drunk, and he gets into all these adventures with this millionaire, and at the same time he falls in love with this blind flower girl who, you know, is basically in need of welfare at a time when the welfare state wasn't in the form it's in now. And basically, Chaplin's character acts as this kind of almost impersonal transmission mechanism between the tremendous opulent wealth of the millionaire who gives away his car, who has too much money, who doesn't need the money, and this kind of pure, innocent, blind, struggling, beautiful girl who is in need of welfare, in need of an operation from importantly, a Viennese European sophisticated doctor, and can't afford it. And the whole, you can read that film simply as Chaplin being the transmission from the rich and the poor.
I would just also add that I think it's really interesting that if Chaplin's like the voice of commonality between all men, in the film City Lights, it's this idea that the millionaire at the time doesn't really tend towards benevolent acts unless he's drunk. And I think there's a famous quote from Chaplin that says a man's true character comes out when he's drunk. And I think that's really telling of his perspective on what wealth really means. It's almost like a regimentation of your feelings and a suppression of your core humanity, which, you know, is done away with when you're allowed to be free in the sense of a drunk person.
I mean, inebriation as a great equalizer, right? It's getting the characters drunk is a comedic device for showing, actually, we're all in this together. And then obviously asking the question, why isn't society organized accordingly? Because it isn't. So, as you pointed out, the millionaire only recognizes Chaplin as his friend, as a common human being that he even cares about when he's drunk, and then immediately returns to distance when he's not.
Also, perhaps more cynically, we could see it as charity only happening when rich people take leave of their senses because they've become intoxicated.
Okay, so on that note, I thought maybe another interesting observation is that there's a sort of element of Jekyll and Hyde with the millionaire. Like, he's by day quite horrible. He doesn't care about any sort of welfare distribution. But when he becomes Mr. Jekyll at night, suddenly he will give the money to the blind girl. And then there's the mistaken identity, or rather the mistaken being mistaken for a thief when he isn't. And I think this is another theme that runs through all the Chaplin films, in so much as he always finds himself in the position where he has accidentally ended up being the culprit when really he's not to blame. And I think, Gavin, you were making the point that sort of epitomizes his general vulnerability and naivety within the social setting. And I was just wondering, in terms of the setting itself, there's obviously an urban connection. He is commenting about the urban state, and I think because he always finds himself in these weird, complex situations with the authority, I personally see him as having quite a complex attitude towards authority and towards the police, in so much as the police, you know, he's always in and out of jail. And yet it's not necessarily seen as such a bad thing going to jail. And I think I see it as jail represents almost a form of discipline, but also a form of welfare in its own right.
Well, just to briefly jump to modern times, which I know we'll go into more detail later. One thing, interesting thing about that film is they refer to the state frequently as the law, which was alien to me in the language of the 21st century. If you talk about orphan children in that film, and it's a silent film, and something just comes up on the screen that says the children were taken control of by the law. You know, even the act of provision for orphans, which is as far away from kind of punishment as we could perhaps think of, is seen as a responsibility of the law, not of what we would now call the state.
I see a pretty strong Marxian theme here, actually, which is to see authority and the social order as something that's put in the service of maintaining property rights. So in pretty much all these, a lot of Chaplin movies, the tramp or the equivalent character is framed for something or is punished for doing something that, as a viewer, you kind of see in the desperation he is in. You kind of feel sympathetic. So in City Lights, viewers don't really mind, even when he does try to hustle some money out of the rich guy in order to help the girl, or in order to get some food, or buy flowers from her, or the operation ultimately. So you can see why this is subversive, right? Because it sort of makes people sympathetic to saying, yeah, you know, the rich people have enough as it is, and it's okay if you take some away to help the poorer ones. It's subversive in the way Robin Hood was subversive, right?
Yeah, but notably, I mean, in Gold Rush, he shares the cabin with the one that goes off the cliff, with three people, one of them and a fellow prospector who's struggling rich but forgotten where, and the third one is a criminal. And the criminal is presented as a threat, and, you know, so there's a sense in which the tramp represents sort of the good underclass, and that there is also a bad underclass of criminals who the good people need to be wary of. And I think this is why I kind of disagree with you in that it's Marxist, because a lot of what Chaplin seems to be doing to me is a kind of old-fashioned moralism where there are good people and there are bad people, and the tramp just happened to be one of the good ones.
In City Lights, one of the real complex characters there is the butler. So frequently as the viewer, we feel the injustices imposed upon the tramp figure when he's unfairly thrown out of the house for being a thief are the result of this butler, who doesn't quite know what's going on, doesn't have access to the information, the knowledge and the scenes that the viewer has, and doesn't understand the friendship that's developed between these two characters, one of whom has had his life saved by the other. The other reading of that is that the butler is the kind of managerial elite, that the millionaire represents the capital. The butler is almost a technocrat, and naturally he is going to be resistant to redistribution of wealth from the owner of capital to the kind of underclass, because he has a more immediate threat from economic competition with characters like Chaplin's. And if you kind of watch it closely, it's normally the butler who's thwarting the tramp in that film.
So should we move on to Modern Times, which is probably, if any of these, the most Marxist, almost explicitly Marxist of all these three films, which famously starts with the scene of Chaplin in the factory, and he's working along assembly line.
I mean, I think not only is it very Marxist in that sense, but the interesting thing for me from the beginning of the film is that the main boss has a likeness to Henry Ford. And I don't know if that was intentional or not, but I think it certainly was something that I picked up on. I don't know if anyone else found that.
The theme is very much about that. I hadn't picked up on the likeness, the facial likeness, but of course the whole theme of this factory is the dehumanization of the individual fitting simply into the production process at the assembly line and so on. So this is Fordism and Taylorism put in practice. This is what it looks like, is what Chaplin is telling us. And of course that has echoes today as well. Not so much in factory work anymore, but in the sort of routine, mind-numbing, delivery services, call centres, all of these things that are also deeply alienating in the way they work out in practice. And of course, what happens in the film is that the tramp character, Chaplin, goes crazy, right? He doesn't fit into this mold. And this is a wonderfully choreographed scene where he gets caught in the wheels of the big machine.
I mean, personally, I see this as a commentary about risk and uncertainty versus stability, efficiency and cornucopia, in so much as Chaplin is sort of telling us that in some ways we need the synchronization to create all this machine wealth, but we as humans are not able to cope with that sort of level of discipline. And for me, Chaplin is like the definitive sort of spanner in the works. He's the bad egg, the one that can't fit in with this highly mechanized, synchronized lifestyle. And any attempt to try and suppress him, as the main guy does when he rolls out this feeding machine, which I think is the iconic moment of the film, is the, this idea to really maximize the productivity of the plant. We have to stop the employees from even having lunch. And it's a terrible disaster because obviously Chaplin is not going to respond very predictably to any of this technology, and the whole thing ends up sort of exploding and there's mess, and it shows that it's really not a viable way to get the most out of humans. But the commentary, I think, is very much focused on this idea that, you know, when you try to eliminate risk out of the system, you inadvertently destabilize it. And as the kind of vagabond, this is a man with no links, no responsibilities. It's a very urban phenomenon. This is, you know, we did not have vagabonds before Metropolis appeared on the scene at all. And they really epitomize this phenomenon of people with no overlords, so to speak.
And just going back to this kind of historiography of coincidence theme in these films, which ties into the humour as well. This is the film for me where everything just, he's so unlucky. Anything that they plan, you know, some slapstick event will happen which derails everything, and that's the humour, but that's the tragedy of it. At the end, they're kind of sitting there broken by it all, him and his partner, and she says there's no hope, there's nothing to do, and he says, you know, you basically get a set of smile, and they walk off, crucially, into the kind of a rural, into the hills, almost like a kind of Grapes of Wrath, moving to California, moving to the south, moving, dispensing with the city. Halfway through that film as well, she moves from a cramped urban living space to their own place, which is in this rural environment. There seems to be a lot going on with that film, with the transition away from the city, or dissatisfaction with this modern life in a city.
So when I saw this, I didn't think it was particularly Marxist. I thought Chaplin and Mauvetet de Rousseau, in that you see the tramp is almost like a noble savage who they try and fit him into the machinery of modern life, but he will inevitably escape it because he's not corrupted yet by the system. And then the ending, when they go back into nature, that seems to be the message to me. It's Rousseau, man is corrupted by the arts and sciences, rather than a Marxist. We can, you know, take control of the arts and sciences for the needs of the worker.
At least corrupted by the way science is marshaled for the purpose of industrial production. There is that, but the message, I think, is broader. Right? It's not just that Chaplin is a misfit and he's the one who can't fit this modern system. So it's not just that Fordism and Taylorism works. It's just that there are a couple of, you know, of misshaped cogs that have to be spat out. The message is broader, I think, that this is bad for everyone. It's just that not everyone can resist it. It's the same as, you know, it foreshadows The Matrix, for example.
So the tramp is essentially the one, like Neo is.
I guess in the sense of being somebody who sets the example of how life can be approached differently, but also being quite realistic about the challenges that involves.
I mean, there's this really nice scene, though, where he gets mistaken for a revolutionary leader and stumbles into this mass protest. And I thought that was quite interesting, mainly because it sent the message to me that when there are these populist undercurrents in play already, it kind of doesn't really matter who takes charge or kind of takes advantage of those forces. Anyone can step into the leadership position because those forces are there anyway. And the fact that Chaplin can take charge of these people is kind of highly indicative of some, you know, forces we see today, I would argue, maybe.
It's funny you say that. I thought exactly the same thing. I mean, what exactly happens is he's walking down the street, he sees a flag, he picks it up, he kind of waves it around because he's a clown. And suddenly behind him, there's this big mob that he hasn't seen. And he starts walking forward to try and give this flag back to the person who's dropped it. And as he edges forward with the crowd, he becomes the leader of the crowd. And it's an amazing scene of just, again, this coincidentalist view of history where, which if you look at how populist uprisings happen, it is not exactly like that, but often it is in some ways comparable to that. The amount of coincidence, sheer chance that involves, you know, deciding who's going to lead these movements is always very, very significant. And in the historical context where this was going on so often, it's difficult to think that someone like Chaplin wasn't aware of that when he choreographs a scene like that. I mean, if you read some of the descriptions of Chaplin earlier, he's almost reminiscent of an Orwell figure in his ability to observe, to kind of to see the truth in things, to see things ahead of his time. If you read a book like Homage to Catalonia, you see precisely the same kind of chaos in terms of the distribution of leadership in an uprising, in a socialist movement.
Yeah, and I just want to say, you mentioned Homage to Catalonia. Izzy has kindly printed off some photos to look at when we're doing this, and you can see that the slogans carried by the mob are in Spanish. They're Libertad and Unidad. It's kind of, it seems like a subtle reference to the Spanish Civil War.
But Martin, I'd love to get your perspective on whether or not this is also a social commentary by Chaplin on the achievability of the American dream and the fact that the pursuit of happiness is in some ways rendered impossible to complete because of the social fabric and the capitalist forces in play. I mean, is that fair?
I think that's entirely fair. I think in all of these films, it proves to be pretty hard to achieve the American dream, at least through work, right? So in the Gold Rush, you strike it lucky, but most people don't. And, you know, if you don't, then no luck for you. In City Lights, it's through this sort of slightly corrupted relationship with the rich that the formal authorities, and maybe that's what the butler is, do everything they can to stop. And it's only the kind of human passions, the drunkenness and that kind of thing, that bring out, and this is where the point about morality, I think, is important. It's ultimately in Chaplin's movies human individual morality that saves the day, not the system, and often against the system. And finally, in modern times, whenever he tries to work, so, you know, he tries to do the right thing, right? What we've heard so much about in US politics recently, people who've tried to do the right thing but can't get ahead. Well, he's sort of the same, right? He shows up for work, you know, when the factory's closed, he loses his job, and then when they open again, he wiggles his way to the front of the queue to get the last job as a machinist assistant or whatever it is. So, you know, he tries to work to feed his wife, girlfriend, his family, to have his own house, to bring food home. So he's doing everything right, but it's quite clear that as he wants to describe the system is not going to make that possible, and it's either luck or some sort of individual virtue that will get you there, but the system isn't helping.
That's really interesting. I mean, so essentially it breaks down to three ways that you can achieve the American dream. One is through luck, one is through being a sycophant, effectively, and the third one is kind of like what we see now with these monopolistic forces, where it's the owners of capital who get all the returns at the cost of the employees. I was just, you know, something that struck me when I was reading the commentary around the time of the release of the film, there was an interview with Chaplin, and they said that one of the inspirations for this film was supposedly the fact that as a multi-megastar, he would do a lot of touring. And it was because he was touring and going from one location to the other that he got to see a really good sort of overview of not just what was happening in America, but also in other areas, although at that time it would have been mainly America. And I just think this resonates with this idea of the urban filter bubble, because if you were in the urban setting, you might have been slightly detached from what was going on in the rural areas. And I think it's really interesting that Chaplin may have been influenced mainly because of his capacity to break through those bubbles.
I just got to, just quickly on modern times and this idea about the mechanical, or the way these mechanical systems don't quite work out. There's a bit of a paradox at play there, because the way Chaplin's humour works, for me, actually, is in some ways the kind of embodiment of mechanics. It's if you read about his method, you know, he's this viewed as this great figure in the history of acting. He had some special capacity to capture things other actors couldn't capture, and his own method seemed to involve, whereas nowadays we might think of people, you know, drawing on their emotions, he just wanted to take care of the physical and the audience would fill in the rest, almost as though, you know, in the same way this character floats around in an agencyless kind of a way as an actor himself, he almost removed his brain from the process. It was about the body. So whilst that film on the one hand does seem to critique a mechanized vision of society, it is also that mechanized format that allows a mechanized approach to humor to find its perfect home.
I sort of disagree with you there. I think you're right in the how Chaplin worked, but I think it's more sort of craft than mechanics. I said I don't really think of him as a Marxist. He's more of, to me, like a William Morris type utopian socialism, like the exercise of creativity, a bohemian lifestyle. That's what these films are saying to me, rather than like reforming the system and taking over the machinery.
Isn't he a libertarian ultimately?
He could be, but also, can't there be a craft in the way you design a, however grotesque it seems, in the way you design a machine that puts food in people's mouths?
I wouldn't call him a libertarian, because that's where this individual virtue comes in, right? The tramp is always a gentleman. I mean, maybe he has some slips now and then, but certainly towards women, he's always a gentleman. He may occasionally, you know, steal a loaf of bread, but it's usually to help somebody else. So it does seem anti-system, but it's not libertarian at the individual moral level. But, you know, on this idea of the machine-like nature of the work, I think there is something to that. There's a kind of clockwork virtuosity in the way he physically moves. I mean, in modern times, he was almost 50 years old. I mean, the sheer acrobatic skill of it is pretty impressive. But also at the level of the comedy, right? So slapstick is sort of, it's almost about collision, almost physical collision. It's, you know, something is going according to, you know, whatever it's set out to be, and then something either literally crashes into it or something goes off the rails. It's that sort of humour. And that goes back to what you were both mentioning before, the importance of coincidence and randomness. So that happens both in the comedy of it. I mean, clowning ultimately, sort of essentially, is about randomness and random disturbances knocking you off course. But that's maybe also the human condition.
Also, I think that's all true. Also, there's an element of the kind of meaning that you can find in abandoning the pursuit of meaning. So, I mean, my favourite scene in modern times was the scene where he sings, which is a significant moment in the history of Chaplin films, because, I mean, he's almost mocking, you know, the use of speech in films, because he sings, suddenly this silent figure is singing, but he's singing nonsense. And at first you think, could this be European language? We've had Spanish signs in the film. I thought it might be European language at first, but after a few verses you realise it's just gibberish. It's a kind of faux Italian in this kind of faux Italian restaurant. Yeah. But then, as the verses wear on, they become more and more conversational, and at the end of every verse there's a punchline. You know, as a listener, there's a punchline to the end of each verse, but there's no language, but you know from the intonation, from his body language, from the jeers of the crowd, that he's delivered some witty riposte or punchline at the end of each of those verses. And it's just a very powerful moment where you realize that it's very easy to overstate the content of words and understate the pragmatics around the delivery of those words.
That moment at the end of Modern Times where he sings, you're right, it's the first time that you hear Chaplin's voice on film. It was the first in all his filmography. That's the first time, 1936. And, you know, voice movies have been in for 8-9 years already by that time, and right? Nobody's doing silent movies anymore. So in a sense, it's, I guess, as an artist, it's his statement saying, OK, voice is coming. But in that scene, as you point out, it's the physical comedy that wins, right? Because the sounds, the voice doesn't say anything. But it's also actually the swan song, because it's the last time the tramp character as such appears in Chaplin's movies. The next movie is The Great Dictator, where he sort of retains some of the mannerism, but it's not the same character anymore. So it's a big moment in his life work.
I think it's really interesting, actually, that not only is he commenting on the rate of technological change and what it's doing to humanity, but he himself is coming out as a bit of a technophobe because he won't adapt to the new talking regime, and he's almost silently protesting. And in City Lights, there's this really interesting mechanism he uses to sort of laugh at the talkies, because he does already have the ability to do synchronized music, and then he uses that at the very opening scene where they're unveiling a statue in the sort of urban square, and he's found to be sleeping overnight in the arms of the statue. And the speeches are kind of mockery of talking. They're like, mah, 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 mah. It's almost like he's saying, I'm not ready to move on, or at least I'm not necessarily anti-tech, but I just think it has to be slowed down a bit. We need to be ready for it.
And also there's that great scene in City Lights where he's at the party, which I think the millionaire calls for him. Like, he's this kind of prodigal son returned to this millionaire. The millionaire's drunk. He throws a party for the tramp. And they get this singer in. And again, you know, singing being, you know, tying into the whole you can now synchronize in films. And the tramp himself continually disrupts the singer. The singer can't perform because the tramp has swallowed this whistle and he keeps hiccuping. And every time he hiccups, it makes a little beep. And the singer can't sing. Or, you know, quite literally, Chaplin is halting the technological progress in the way films work in his own film. There was a double meaning to that scene as well, because I really took from that scene the kind of double standards of decorum. One of the most difficult things I find when watching old films is to understand what contemporary audiences would have found offensive. Maybe they didn't look for the signs of virtue that we look for, but they look for very specific rituals. In terms of the way people behave, to judge what kind of background they were from. And to hiccup continually in polite society, I believe at that time would have been an egregious act. It would have been a terrible thing to do. And many people viewing it wouldn't have thought necessarily it was humorous, but it was also a despicable thing to do in polite society, the way you could do that. I mean, the double standards are simply that the millionaire is this raging alcoholic and no one ever complains about that. He's kind of stumbling around himself, you know, in the middle of the street, but he's a millionaire, so he gets away with it. But Chaplin, you know, actually evicts himself from that party because he's arguably so humiliated by his own conduct, he can't fit in polite society.
At the end of the last film we're discussing, Modern Times, of course, he exiles himself also from almost from society. Right? You mentioned how they leave the city. But it's not just that, because at the end, they have jobs. Right? Things are looking good for them. The girl has a job as a singer. He's a singing waiter. And what happens is that the police catches up with them, and it's because she's a vagrant, which means that it's sort of child services because she's minor, I suppose, wanting to take custody of her and, I suppose, put her into a home or jail or something, but restricting her freedom. Right? And they run away. So they don't only escape the city, they escape the jurisdiction of organized society. And that's where, you know, that's again, that's the last time you see the tramp when he walks into this rural sunset, but he also leaves society. And, you know, it's sort of a mix of defiance and resignation, maybe.
In terms of influences, though, obviously before we had Modern Times in Europe, there would have been Metropolis, Fritz Lang, 1927, I believe. That's obviously a very similar story in some ways. I mean, it's obviously far more technological and much more dark in many ways, but I think there is a commonality between the two films, and certainly there is a common critique of what it means to live in a high functioning metropolis and at what cost that comes, namely the underclasses. So I was just wondering, like, in terms of the metropolis synergy, do you think Chaplin would have been influenced by something like that? Or, I mean, certainly it was a big hit back in the day, no?
I'm sure, I mean, he obviously will have watched it, and it's a fantastic film and was recognised as such. And by the time he made Modern Times, Fritz Lang obviously had moved to the US, escaped Nazi Germany. I don't know if they knew each other, but I'd be surprised if they didn't. So clearly the theme about this omnipotent machine and the city as an inhuman machine, that's clearly the same in Modern Times. They go in different directions, though, because in Metropolis there is this sort of fantasy that remains there that you can actually unite the interests of the different classes and this sort of hope. In Modern Times, as we just discussed, the only hope is exit in the end. You have to escape.
Yeah, I think it would be remiss of us not to discuss the final scene in City Lights, given it's, you know, such a powerful scene, one of the great moments in cinematic history. But it's actually quite a tragic film from that very perspective, because the blind flower girl falls in love with someone who she thinks is a gentleman. She first hears a car door slamming shut, and from then on she thinks it's a gentleman, but it isn't a gentleman, it's a tramp. And the final scene where they're kind of face-to-face, where he realises that... there's a long scene where he is realising she will soon realise that, and then she tries to give him money at the very end of the film, and she tries to give him a farthing, and eventually she touches him and realises that he's the one who's helped her throughout the whole film, and then it zooms on his face, and you don't know... you can't really read his face, which is why it's such brilliant acting. It ends in complete uncertainty. But we know that her hopes have been throughout the film that there was this prince to rescue her, that there was this fairy tale ending, this Hollywood ending, and there is no Hollywood ending. It's a reverse prince into a frog situation. And, you know, whatever else we know about the film, we can be pretty sure that viewers putting themselves in the shoes of the flower girl would have rather that it were the rich gentleman who walked into the shop 5 minutes earlier than the tramp. However much they laugh at the tramp.
And in that respect, it's a more mature, much more mature film than The Gold Rush, which has this sort of fairy tale ending, right? He gets rich, the girl recognizes him, they meet, and so on. City Lights is much truer, and we haven't actually mentioned that we should say it. City Lights, 1931, 2 years into the Great Depression. The Gold Rush was during the bubble, and that must count for something. I mean, the social atmosphere has completely transformed, much less hope. And, I mean, it's even worse than the way you describe it, because when she sees him at the end, so she's had the operation, she now sees this tramp outside the shop window where she now works, and she and the other shop girls laugh at him because he's such a miserable, funny-looking little tramp. And he's sitting there completely besotted, seeing her again because he had sort of lost her, didn't know where she was. And she laughs to the others and say, well, not with voice, but with these, the written captions, I think he's fallen in love with me, ha, ha, ha. You know, obviously somebody of a different social status. And then when when she gives him the money and touches his hands and recognizes him through the touch, she freezes. And he says, so the tramp says, you can see now. And she says, yes, I can see now. And that's where it ends. So what does that mean? She sees something. What is it she sees?
I think there's something of the audience seeing themselves in her there, where for 90 minutes we've been laughing at this character, throughout all these films. What does our laughter really mean? Is there a cruelty in our laughter, like the very naked cruelty at the end of that film? Well, you're right, the piercing line is where she says to her friends, I think I've got an admirer here, which is also what Georgia says in The Gold Rush. And it's that talking about him as though he's not there that is the kind of the cruelest thing about it, which is, as the audience, precisely what we're doing. It's what we're doing now. There's an idea of a human being created in these films who, you know, exists in the absence of him ever being a meaningful object of our discourse.
The film we've not discussed, which people probably know where Charlie jumped from, is The Great Dictator. And the very end of that film, when he gives this speech, is almost like he steps out of that Trump role when he does become a meaningful figure in, as you say, our discourse. And it's not funny at all. It's very, very heartfelt. It's very, very... it's a mix of optimism and pessimism, both quite profound optimism and quite profound pessimism, in saying, you know, in that film, his love interest is a girl called Hannah, and he's speaking later, and he says, you know, the human spirit is soaring, you can hear my voice, because in that film, he is sent to a concentration camp. So it's a lot... it's even bleaker than the other ones, and you can sort of see through these films that pessimism coming through. And then the very end, the Hannah, I think, in the very end of Great Dictator, she just collapses on the floor.
What I found really interesting, though, is that in the speech, there is a real emphasis on the machine situation. Like, the speech focuses very much on, like, we must be pro-progress, but we must not be pro-progress at any cost, that we must not be, like, these men of machines. I think that's a really interesting connection, mainly because before the whole, like, you know, technological disruption that we've started to see these days, I don't think we would have necessarily have zoomed in on that as much as some other aspects of the fascist forewarnings that were being put through in that speech. Whereas I now, in hindsight, and with respect to everything that's going on now, you know, there's a, you know, he's saying machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical. Our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent and all will be lost. Now, perhaps this is a good time to bring in what I think are some interesting parallels with the Trump phenomenon, because, you know, to some degree, I'm going to put forward the case that Trump has maybe, I mean, probably totally unwittingly, harnessed much of the Chaplin mentality. He portrays himself very much the clown as well. We see this continuous inconsistency. We see this continuous of playing to the crowds, taking, you know, the crowd that knows him is with him, and then to the outsiders, the sort of neoliberal elite, they don't see him for what he is. They see him from the perspective of those that Chaplin would, in his own films, have mocked. And there's also some other interesting parallels. Chaplin was supposedly a big fan of FDR. He was a big fan of these New Deal movements. And, you know, Mr. Trump is not necessarily going to build a Hoover Dam, but he might be building a wall. And we now can see the stimulus side of his policies and his appealing to the left behind, but also in a way that resonates with them. So there's a bit of humanity, not just sort of appeal on the political front. What do you think of that?
I'm in complete agreement with that. I mean, one of the consequences we talked about technological change. If you've got, you know, the work of art in an age of mechanical reproduction, a lot more people, one of the consequences, a lot more people consume that art, be it cinema, be it literature. We've had this trajectory leading up to Chaplin of all kinds of concerns from intellectuals about the masses consuming art, what effect that has on them. There's this fear of the folly of the crowds that comes to the fore in the Victorian era, that some people reacted to Chaplin along much the same lines. And a lot of people, if you read the way people criticise the results of the US election, the same themes are at play, with fear of kind of this mass folly, these delusions.
It's quite clear that that Trump has succeeded in harnessing some of the same forces and some of the same turmoil that Chaplin made his art about. You mentioned the speech from The Great Dictator, and some of the words there would resonate perfectly today. Machinery that gives us abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical. I think there are a lot of people who voted for Trump who feel exactly that way. He even talks about mass communication and how it should bring us closer together, but it hasn't. What is Twitter and social media, right? But there's a very key difference, and that is just, you have to contrast the meanness of Trump and his campaign with the kindness and that lies at the heart of this Trump, the tramp. The Trump versus the tramp. The meanness of Trump versus the kindness of the tramp.
I can see that point. On that note, though, I just want to very quickly point to a review, an early review of Chaplin in 1915 from an essayist called Ben Hecht, who wrote this in Chicago. And he said of Chaplin's tramp, he is cruel, he is absurd, unmanly, tawdry, cheap, artificial. And yet beyond his crudities, his obscenities, his inartistic and outrageous contortions, his divinity shines. He is the mob god, he is a child and a clown, he is a gutter snipe and an artist. He is the incarnation of the latent, imperfect and childlike genius that lies buried underneath the fibreless flesh of his worshippers. They have created him in their image. He is the mob on two legs. They love him and laugh. It's Chaplin. It's also Trump, isn't it?
I think Martin is so flabbergasted by that, he has no reaction.
1915 is important because the character did develop from these very crude slapstick movies of the first couple of years towards the much more morally complex character that that Gavin also talked about in the 20s, and especially the 30s. I mean, I think there are two sides to clowning, right? There are two sides to theatre and to art and to humanity. There's a dark side and there's a light side. And I think the best of Chaplin, at least, points us to that lighter side.
So unfortunately, we're coming to an end in terms of our timing here in the podcast suite. So we've got to call it a day. But I mean, I feel we only just scratched the surface, and perhaps we can come back one day and discuss these themes again. But for now, sadly, I think on that Trump versus Tramp note, we're going to have to say goodbye.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed our conversation. Please let us know what you think. You can email us at alphachat@ft.com or give us a call at +1 917 551 5012. And please rate the show on iTunes. It really helps other people find it. Alpha Chat will be taking a brief break next week for US Thanksgiving. But
support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Cardiff will be back the following week.